Everyone, this is Lloyd. And I'm back with the interview that I promised with Mike Blackgrave. Mike, as you know, is pretty well known in the combatives world. I've trained with him before. He's a fantastic guy. I consider him a friend. And yeah, let's kick off for this. I hope you guys are going to enjoy this one. I think it's going to be very interesting. I've had fantastic conversations with him in the past. So, hey, Mike, thanks for being on the thanks for the discussion.
Hey, you're welcome, man. Glad to be here.
Yeah, great. Great to have you on. So, we've known each other for a little while. I met you back in the past. We've chatted and had a great time in Texas. Just for those who don't know you, do you want to give us a little bit of your background, personal history? Just tell us how you got to, where you came from
Sure.
and how you got to be to where you are.
Well, I've gotten to the age of 54 years of age because I'm pretty smart and pretty keen. But I came up in a little small country town in southern Indiana. My father was my first instructor. He did combat judo that he learned in the 101st. So he always had me in the backyard working me on that. And, we never had a whole lot to go train at because it's a small country town. But I used to buy karate magazines of all things, and I would follow along and I would mimic as best I could until I could find something. When I got into the army, of course, like there's all types of people from all over the country in the army who knows a lot more than I did, and I just gravitated to those guys and they taught me little things. And I trained Hawaiian Kempo with a few of my friends in that and boxed. And from there, when I came out of the service, I moved to San Antonio, Texas, which being a big city, just had a plethora of martial arts to choose from. So I stayed with Kenpo for a long time. Moved my way into, of course, Wing Chun, Goju-Ryu, earned teaching credentials in four or five of those arts. And then it came the day that I got stabbed and I realized I didn't know a whole heck of a lot about knives and how to fight against them. So I undertook Pikkiti Tersha Kali for 9 years. And that led me into the Illustrissimo Kali for several years and into the Penchak Silats, but all along, always still training Wing Chun and things like that. So I just kind of, at the end of the day, I put everything together and developed my own CMOC system after years and years and years of doing it. But I still teach traditional old school Wing Chun, I call it, because I believe it has some of the best empty hands in the game, and I think people need that. That coupled with the combatives that I've learned from here and there, and different workshops, learning from you, of course, and I just kind of take all the methodologies, and to me, it's all motion. You just got to find out what's relative and put it together and let it work and let it flow through you and take it to your laboratory and work it.
Nice, man. I actually had no idea you had such an extensive CV,
I've been at it
in the
a long
martial arts.
time, 38 years. I started my 38th year, February 1st.
Nice, congratulations. That's a long history of martial arts, man.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I love it. I don't know how to play
So,
golf and I don't know how to play tennis, so that's about it. You know?
yeah, okay, well, that's understood. You don't look to me like a golf guy, man. I can
No,
see you in
no.
golf pants.
I never got past the ninth hole before they asked me to leave. Something about throwing clubs in the lake they didn't like. I don't know.
Okay, well, one of those golfers. All right, so you'd be McEnroe
Pretty
essentially
much.
if this was tennis.
Pretty much. Pretty much.
Yeah, man, that's actually very, very interesting history. So of those arts, I mean, obviously you have a talent for Wing Chun, you have an affinity for Wing Chun, and I'll definitely get to asking you why, but which of those arts do you think had the biggest influence on you, or can you tell us a little bit about what you maybe took out of each art that was relevant to you, and that
Yeah.
which pieces you built into CMOC?
Well, CMOC was based heavily at first with my Illustrissimo work because I actually broke my back in a car wreck two times in 2 years. And for 7 months, I couldn't walk. And when I came back to training, a lot of the Pikkiti Tersha and the Penchak Silat stuff, which I loved because it flowed so beautifully and it was very powerful in these things. I couldn't do a lot of the waving in and the waving out and a lot of the low postures and stuff like that because, I broke my lower back twice in 2 years. And I mean, that's just kind of debilitated a lot of my motion. So when I went over to the Philippines, I learned from Yuli Romo directly, and we trained and trained, and he actually taught me about how to move my body that behooved my injuries and didn't go against them. You know, that's why you'll see everything I do. I have my weight over my hips. You don't see me doing any type of crazy elongated moves or anything that's going to put any type of pain or anguish on my lower back, because no matter what I know, if I throw my back out in the in a street situation, I'm done. I mean, I throw my back out getting out of bed, and I was down for a week, so I got to be real careful. So I learned how to use the Lestrisimo quite a bit, and I built CMOC off of that because the Lestrisimo is just very, very simple. I mean, there's only a certain amount of things to do, and it doesn't take a lifetime to master. Tatang had the old adage of everything I do is a number one. Everything I do is going to be offensive. Even his defense was offense. And then, of course, being a Kempo guy, one of my big joys in my life was actually getting to cross hands with Ed Parker when I was a very young man at an American Kempo workshop that he performed. And,
man, you've made me jealous.
Yeah, and it was only a brief instant, but I got to meet the man and I got to cross hands, and he stuck with me for one simple reason. I'm about the same size as he was, maybe a little bigger, and he was always one of those guys who would say if a big man could do it, anybody can do it. And so I invested my time greatly in American Kempo. I have all his books, all his writings, and a lot of my motion and my movement I compound from those books. So I took a lot of the American Kempo blasting ability, a lot of just the simple science of the motion, and placed into it. From American Kempo, I kind of did the reverse of what Jeff Speakman did. Jeff Speakman came from Goju-Ryu, USA Goju under Lou Angel, into American Kempo. I went from American Kempo into USA Goju. And out of USA Goju, what I took from the Goju training, because I made Nidan in that, what I took from that is discipline. It was one of the hardest undertakings martially I ever did, because my instructor was a very old school cat who learned directly under Osensei Peter Urban. And when you walked into the dojo, it was straight discipline, kihon drills, everything.
You know, Mike, just in this opening segment, I can see reason to sit down and have several conversations with you. Because, man, it sounds like a lifetime of experience right there, and so many different paths you've walked.
It's been an amazing journey. And but I really do believe, though, out of all the systems I've trained, and I've trained, like I said, four to instructor level and beyond, that Wing Chun calls to me the most due to one simple reason.
Yeah.
I believe Wing Chun can transcend methodology, where a lot of the other ones, while they can, not as easy, because I never looked at Wing Chun as a martial art. I've always looked at Wing Chun as the science of infighting. It's based on angles and geometries. It's based on simplicity of motion. And I believe with that mindset, Wing Chun has always been very easy for me to learn. I never had teachers who elongated it, where, you know, some, I'm not going to name names because I don't want to hell with it. Some of the lineages, they drag this stuff out 5, 6, 7 years because it brings money to them. I've always been fortunate in my Wing Chun journey that I've had teachers like Sifu Scott Baker, who was my first really deep, deep teacher, who flat told me 2 years maximum to go through the physical syllabus of Wing Chun. After that, it's on.
Could this be because he distilled the syllabus, or he was teaching an authentic syllabus, or third, that he saw the talent within you to learn it within that period?
I think a little bit of all three. I only trained with Sifu privately. I never did group lessons in Wing Chun, always private lessons, because Wing Chun, from my knowledge, is always best dispelled one-on-one. And I've always been a dedicated student, and him and I had a lot in common. We were both very, very big. He was from New Zealand, just a huge man, bigger than me. And he said he used to get beat up by all the Tongans and all the Maoris, and he needed to learn how to defend himself. So he went to the Wing Chun Academy, and all the guys beating him up were in there.
Okay, so let's pause there a second. Let's step back, because, man, you open up so many interesting doors. You know, it's like all these choices. Can we step back? I mean, there's lots of people. You're renowned for, as far when I learned about you because of your Filipino martial arts knowledge.
Yeah.
Right. That's where I heard about you. That's what I read about you. You're something of a historian, I believe.
Yes, I'm like you. I'm a historian of martial arts. I'm a hoplologist. I study all arts and their cultures and their histories and things like that.
Yeah, which I found fascinating, and that's how I got to know you as a historian of the martial arts before I got to know you as a martial artist. And tell us a little bit about, I think this would be very interesting to a Filipino martial artist and to me as well, who's not that familiar with that, but speak to me about Yuli Roma, your impressions of him, and also Ilustrissimo and what you've taken from it, and maybe I would say on a skill building or technical level, what the benefits of Ilustrissimo are versus,
Yeah.
I mean, I'll let you run with that if you would.
Training with Mong Yuli Romo was an eye-opening experience because he is an old-school guy who was Tatang's. I guess some people call him his first student, some people call him his second student, due to the fact that Tatang really didn't start teaching till he was much, much older. But Yuli, when you go to train with him, he's very charismatic to begin with. He's a cad, but he is dead fast and resolute on you learning. So he's very demanding. My first lesson with him, true lesson, was on his home island in Camotes. He picked up a pida, a short sword, and he looked at me and he said, "Michael, move or die." And he swung it at my face. And immediately, I moved out of the way. And so started my lessons. He takes you to a point of total frustration and pushes you past that point of total frustration for one simple reason. I had a lot of Pikiti Tersa habits in me, and Pikiti Tersa does a toe tapping methodology where their feet are always in front of them. And while working with Yuli, he destroyed those legs. I mean, he kept dropping down low to those legs to the point where I was so frustrated I didn't know what I could do. I didn't know if I was ever going to get what he was trying to teach me. And the genius of the man is one day he came to me and he said, "Take this stick and go down to the sea and practice. No training with me today. Make it work for yourself." And I started to see it. I started to feel it. And then every day for 7, 8, 9 hours on his home island, we would just train with barong, with knife, with empty hands, with stick, with sometimes just sitting down, having a cold beer and having a discussion was the greatest lessons of all. So when you train with Yuli, he was just a very open, charismatic guy, but he demanded performance. And he didn't care how much you were paying him, he demanded performance because I was representing him. So in that 27 days that I trained with the man, I would say close to over 200 hours with him privately. And thus, I was able to get it. The thing that about Illustrissimo that I found for me that work better is it covets the medium ground. Yes, there's a long range component, and yes, there's a short range component, but where a lot of Filipino systems use the medium ground for either bridging in or bridging out, Ilustrissimo, the way I was taught, uses the medium ground to launch the attacks. And once those
All
attacks
right.
launch the medium ground, I still have the option to close or go out. But the attacks are such that they're very simple but very devastating. I've always called it a head art because a lot of the stuff that I was taught, I mean, we're talking about working a barong and I'm working past the hands into the neck and then always finishing up with a low line thrust to the belly and another cut. Tatang had a saying, "When the blade touches flesh, it stays on flesh." So kind of like moving your body around the opponent, not the opponent around you. It's an amazing, amazing simple art. And when I spar with guys, stick spar with guys from other systems, they get frustrated with me because I make them do all the moving. Using the three ranges the way I was taught, if you want to hit me, what do you have to do? You have to bridge in to hit me. So if I'm sparring a guy, say from Pikiti or whatever, who likes to move a lot, and every time he moves, I simply move off of an angle and gain a little more
Right.
distance. Gain a little more distance.
I just want to define two terms so we get on the same page as you, as how you mean it. What to you is medium range in terms of Illustrissimo?
In the Illustrissimo, if you put your hold your stick, say a 28-inch stick, okay, and now
Right.
hold it straight out in front of you, pointed at your other man, those two tips touching is considered long range. Now put your stick straight back up in your hand, correct? And touch fist to fist. That is medium range. Now your arm slides down my arm where your fist is on my outside shoulder, my fist is on your outside shoulder. That is considered close range.
Close range. All right.
Yeah.
Okay, that's great. And how do you define bridging?
Bridging for us is when I hit that medium ground, if I decide to go in, I must use a technique, a body mechanic that could safely get me past that medium distance and past your weapon into the close distance. I may use cadena real, for instance, where if you come down with number one strike or a 12 strike over the head down towards me, branching off to a left 45 step, which takes from medium to close, bringing my roof block up, stopping that weapon, and then sliding all the way up into your chest as I whip that stick back around or the blade into the neck. Thus, I bridged in medium, stepped into close, and finished in close. But then to be safe, I'm going to drop that weapon and pin and then slide back out to the medium range and then, if need be, fall back out to the long range. To describe it sounds confusing. To see it, once I show people it, they're like, oh, okay, that's simple. Because all you're using is diamond footwork, what they call single caneta. It's where one foot is moving and you're just sliding the feet in and out of three different ranges.
All right. Now, that's interesting because I think different people define long, medium, and short in different ways. So it's some perspective.
Definitely. Definitely.
Obviously, Illustrissimo is a very formative art.
Yeah, it's blade art. It is a blade art.
All right. And for your empty hand component, I think this is where I know that you've got a particular take on Wing Chun where you also see it as a bladed art.
Yeah, Wing Chun to me is a bladed art. I've always said it is a bladed art. If you understand the hands of Wing Chun, you'll see the blade, you'll see the Bat Jam Dao. And to even confuse the audience more, if you look at the long pole is the precursor training device for the double blades. Here again, you have to have that open mindset and you have to have somebody who teaches you that way. So many people teach Wing Chun as a chain punching art, as a fisticuff art, which it is. It has those components. But in reality, depending on where you learn and who you learn from, it's a bladed art. I mean, if you look at Gonsal's, the way a Gonsal cuts, if you just put a knife in your hand, if you look at all the eight pieces to the Bat Jam Dao set, all eight pieces are also empty hand components. So a lot of times with my students, I'll run the eight blade set or the eight pieces to the set empty handed with my people. And they're just like, oh, okay, that's San Sao, that's Tan Sao, that's Pak Sao. Now I put a blade in your hand. Oh, that's a chop. That's a cut. So you have to have a conceptual mind because Wing Chun is conceptual art.
Now, I can relate to you. I think in the training we've done together, I think there's a similarity there in that I would say, well, look, empty hand, take out the knife, same thing. Put the knife back in, same thing, deadlier, but same thing.
And even with Illustrissimo, because Sifu Dustin Carroll is who I train with now in Wing Chun, and he's learning CMOC via me. And we talk all the time, and we're just amazed that he's like, well, we do that in Wing Chun. And I'm like, well, we do it in Illustrissimo. Holy crap, it's the same thing. It's just the delivery system may be a little bit different depending on the intent. But the motion of the hand, you know, let's be honest, a chop is a chop, a punch is a punch, and a cut is a cut, and a back fist is a back fist. You know, now the delivery system, how to get it.
So do you think that at a certain level, each of these arts have discovered, shall we say, certain universal principles, and they simply express them according to the culture or the mind of the practitioner? But there's a certain unifying set of principles.
Exactly what it does. Exactly. Exactly what it does.
I've seen you do Wing Chun. I mean, we've sparred somewhat, and you're very strong on off angling. You're very strong on defense, right? You're very strong on structure, and of course, short range punching. Wing Chun, people do know Wing Chun, as you said, as a hand to hand art. Which of these arts that you've done is your primary hand to hand component within CMOC?
Wing Chun, by far. And in reality, most of the violent hand-to-hand altercations I've ever had, and I've had quite a few of them with my past, I've reverted back to Wing Chun. Because to me, it is simple. And let's be honest, when somebody's going to offer their chin up on a platter, and I come right down the middle with chain punches and off angle with elbows, it just came naturally from me. It just did. Everything just seemed natural. Now, that's not to say that I didn't utilize other pieces from other things, but that initial concept of Wing Chun, of hitting the son of a gun in the face until until he drops and stops, has just rung true with me. Now, you know, I've boxed in all this as well, But Wing Chun just always made sense in that regard for the street. It's just fast, nasty, and just be first and use it, you know? And it has a long distance component that most people, they say it doesn't have a long distance empty hand component, but it has a very nice long distance component if you understand it and you train it.
Tell us more about that. I mean, that's an interesting perspective. It's
Well,
usually seen as a fairly close range system.
if you look at Wing Chun, everybody says you maintain center. Where your center line has to be on his center line. I never learned Wing Chun that way. I learned to control my center. I could care less about his center. If I can control my center, where I take my center is the key. And there's drills called pole punching. And within the pole punching, you're literally punching to the point where your center will now be off of him, and you're using what they call a long bridge. Where I'm punching with my lat, with my back muscles, I push that through there and my body comes off angle because I want to drive that fist. When I close the rear hip back, now I got back to a short bridge, which for the body shot or whatever it's going to be. But this is the same thrusting motion from the long pole sections, from when the long pole sits up high into the chest cavity when you thrust out. And that's actually the same thing as the long pole punching or a pole punch. Also, the kicks of Wing Chun, where people say it doesn't have a long range game, I beg to differ. Here again, it all comes down to how you use your kicks. Sure, some kicks are going to be better in a long distance or in a short distance, you know, Joe Gurk low side kicks. But the way we do the number one kick to two Gurk is totally different than how a lot of people do it. A lot of people use that as a push kick. We don't do that. We use it as a lift kick, where I'm literally. My leg is as long as it is, and I'm lifting it up into certain areas, almost like a jab, almost like a probe. I'm not pushing it at all. I'm using my body as a fulcrum. As my top of my body leans back, my foot comes up. And I'm just trying to touch with it. I'm just trying to pop with it inside of the knee, scrotum, wherever I'm going. And then the back kick is the one that comes in heavy. And we use that more as a stomp kick as opposed. In the lineage of Wing Chun that I train, with Sifu Carroll, which is Duncan Leung, we don't have what we call kicks per se. Everything is a break. All our kicks are designed to break something. You know, break the side of the knee, break the top of the foot, break the inside of the knee. If I get you on the ground, smash out the elbow with a low.
Do you find these as stumps then?
Yeah, they're probing, they're probes, lifts, and stomps. That's what they are. And all into structure. We want to take you off your feet. We want to blow into structure. And they work nastily. Nastily? Is that even a word?
I guess it is now.
It is now nastily.
Yeah, I think it should be a legal word.
Yeah.
I'm just curious then, because you've given me so much to work. I mean, there's so much to discuss, right? So I don't want to dwell too long on one thing because I'm curious about so many things now. In terms of karate, I mean, most people obviously have the view that, but I love traditional martial arts. I mean, things like I trained in karate, like I think we all did,
Yeah.
growing up. I loved the just the crispness of the form, the discipline, which you referred to. And I love things like Tai Chi. I just think it's beautiful. It's something you can do for the rest of your life, you know,
Sure.
and you can enjoy them. So there's a lot of value there. And I think for kids, they're great. But
Yeah.
from the Goju that you learned, what was the value that you took from that?
Well, Goju to me, I learned O Sensei Peter Urban's USA Goju, which had the original 12 Nahakatas from Okinawa, but it also had Japanese variations of it. And then it also had what he called his 10 urban opuses, his own katas, Kororunfa, and all these different things that he put together. And the thing I find out about Goju, especially USA Goju, is Master Urban had a way of getting to you, and he had in his books, he talked about it. He would train you by your size, and all his people would train you by your size. He would always say that the small man must be tenacious, must be fast. The medium-sized man must be vicious, must be quick to hands, have a good sidekick, and things like that. The big man must be good at holding and hitting, must be ruthless with his fists. And so while we learned all the kicks and stuff like that, my Goju instructor taught me like that. Being 6 foot 5, you know, always, I've been over 275 most of my life. I mean, I learned how to use Goju in a very brutal, very ruthless way. I mean, grabbing a guy's gi, grabbing a guy's shirt, and just pounding into the ribs, crushing, using low types of kicks, very practical stuff, nothing fancy.
You're a bigger guy, which means that you have an advantage over a smaller guy, lighter guy, less powerful guy, right? Some people, I mean, there's some people look at a big guy and say, okay, well, he doesn't have the same size. Well, how can I phrase this? Skill versus the advantage that size and height and strength gives you. You know, how do you work with that? Because there are smaller guys that may not have, they don't have your advantages. So you can compensate in certain ways. So tell us about how the smaller guy, and if you had to teach a smaller guy, how would you then translate that so that he develops his skill versus your advantages?
I go ahead and I throw out speed and I throw out power, because those two things will naturally come to your degree of physicality. What I harp on when I teach everybody is timing. Timing, timing, timing. Because for a very big man, I'm very fast. I can match most people's speed, even as big as I am. That's just something I've worked on. But is it really speed or is it timing? And I've worked on timing using footwork. I am keen on body mechanics and timing. Body mechanics, timing, and footwork. That's all 3-1. If you have that, if you have the footwork and the mechanics down, you will have timing. And timing can offset speed, and timing can offset power, because if you're there first, that's your timing. And that's what I work with guys. So I let them train with me. And I mean, I still take an ass beating at 54 years of age. My guys are pounding on me, throwing me, all kinds of stuff, because I want them to know that if it works on somebody like me, and I just don't lollipop and give people stuff, you have to earn it. But I believe people need to back up the training wheels a little bit, the way they train. And this is another thing I learned from my Goju instructor, that to understand all this, there's three phases to training. There's learning mode, there's training mode, and there's fighting mode. A lot of schools go directly into a training mode or directly into a fighting mode, and they totally forget about the learning mode, which to me is the most important mode. That's where mimicry is king, and you must have it. You must show them how their feet must go. You must show them how this step must go. That doesn't mean they're stuck there forever. As a matter of fact, I can take a beginning Wing Chun student or Goju student and have his footwork up to par within a matter of sessions. Will it be perfect? No, but it'll be workable. And so without that learning mode, you never get that. You don't see the crispness when people throw the elbow. You don't see the crispness in the punch. You don't see the elbow down. You don't see these things if you negate the learning mode. And learning mode is the key to proper timing. And that's how I teach: learning mode, training mode, fighting mode.
I like that. One of the things when we met in San Antonio, one of the things I think we agreed on very, very immediately was starting with proper footwork.
Mm-hmm.
And you just raised that as, you know, talking about using footwork as your example. Do you want to tell us a bit about your philosophy of footwork? I do feel it's very important. It's one of the critical foundational lessons for the beginners. So do you want to tell me about your philosophy on that a little bit?
My philosophy on footwork is footwork will save your jaw from getting knocked across a parking lot.
Mike, you remind me so much of Mr. Parker when you talk, just the way you speak, the quotes you make.
But it's true. So many people, when you go, you go to a martial arts school, the next first thing you know, they're teaching you how to block this or block that or block this, but they're giving you no idea of why you're doing what you're doing, because they're not reverse engineering anything. My total perspective on this: if I can get my people to have good footwork and get their hands up and be able to move and evade, that's the first thing. That's going to frustrate whoever is trying to take their head off. And while you're teaching him to move and evade with proper angles, maybe a 45, a left 90, a rear 45, or even if they're up against the wall and they can't step, to understand footwork by body shifts, things like that, that doesn't take long. And look, teach them how to throw a proper 1-2, a proper 1-2 combination. You will be surprised at how many bad guys you set square on your ass. And that's just the bottom line. You have to be able to teach people not to be hit, but in that same mode, how to throw something out. And my first strikes I teach people are very, very simple. It's a bilge. Put your fingers like this. If he comes in and jab him straight in the eye, because if nothing else, Body dynamics tells me he's not going to fight through that. He's going to turn his head for a brief second, which gives you the opportunity to do what? Either knee him in the nuts and get out, or just get out, period. And that's very, that's the, that, and I learned that from Kempo. Mr. Rick Castro, that was the first thing they taught us in American Kempo class. Move, 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 move. Same thing Yuli taught me, move or die. Same thing in Goju, move off the line. You never stay on the line of a freight train. Get off tracks.
Yeah, you know, I said you remind me so much of Ed Puck in the way you use your words. Is it enough, Kempo?
Oh, yeah, that's one of my favorite books. I referred to, matter of fact, I put up a post on that today on Facebook.
Yeah, no, I realized. I was thinking about that. Because you do. I mean, just the things you used to say used to remind me, and then I was surprised to learn that you had a Kempo background. Can I tell me a little bit about what you took. I know we're touching on a few things briefly, but there's so much to explore. I don't want to get lost down just the FMA rule.
Sure.
Tool. You know, so yeah. Just so that we get a really good overview of who you are, what you do, and I think these are some of the subjects people don't know very well about you. So Kempo, what was the value that you took from the Kempo?
I would say the best value that I took from Kempo came from Mr. Parker. It was hit him with a brick first and then use karate. That mindset in Kempo, and maybe it's just the guys I've trained with, the type of man I am, the type of person I've always been. I've always sought out more hard-ass people to teach me than I did Goody Two Shoes. So my Kempo guys, Rick Castro was a dude from, I think it was San Jose, California. He's a pretty rough guy. And everything that we learned was to hit hard, to hit fast, to be first. Everything that you touch, you hurt. Everything. Be evasive, but yet be direct. And just those little oddities like that. Mr. Castro used to have a saying that said, when he throws a punch, block it with your head and come up underneath and take out the neck. And I was like, block it with your head? What do you mean? I'm sitting there literally thinking, am I going to put my head in there? And he goes, no. They throw it, evade, slip, slide, come under, hit. And I was like, oh, yeah, block it with your head. Hence, block it with your mind, your thoughts, your intelligence. And I was thinking, me being the dumb guy, I was the type.
Block with your face.
Yeah, exactly. And then when I asked him, he was a boxer, not unlike a lot of the original Kempo guys, Frank Trejo. A lot of these guys were good boxers. So the Kempo that he taught me, a guy would throw a right hand or try to slip a jab, step off 45-degree angle, come up underneath it, chop into the ribs, bring him down, and then bring that same very same chop to the back of the neck and push him to the side. And Mr. Castro would say, next. And I was like, wow. So from Kempo, I just took that ability to blast, you know, that rapid fire, pop, 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 and that with the movement and how to really slap a guy. Because I don't think there's a better art in the world at slapping than Kempo. And that's where I thought my mom could slap until I was actually slapped by Mr. Parker in that demo. Holy crap. You know, he slapped me in my upper shoulder after he turned me, and I thought my whole back was on fire. And so I learned things like that. I learned a lot of street fighting because, you know, Kempo is a street art. It came from the Palamas settlements. That's where Mr. Parker was from. That's where he developed it. Professor Chow was no joke. He trained with those type of guys, and that's where Ed developed his stuff. And, you know, I always took that street mentality that those guys taught, and I just ran with it. To me, Kempo was one of the most difficult arts for me to learn because it's a very technical art. But once you get into the technical phases and start to understand a little bit of the motion, it came quite easy. So, yeah, I mean, with Mr. Parker, it was meeting him, opened my eyes, and then I trained with Mr. Speakman. I trained with Larry Tatum. I attended workshops with every guy, Huck Palanis, all these guys, and they all had a little bit different perspective. But the one perspective that crossed the Kempo lines was hit hard, hit fast, hit first, and hit often. And that's what I took with me.
As you know, I'm a Kempo practitioner as well. I train at the moment. I train twice a week with an instructor here in Cape Town. A friend of mine is second degree. Of those guys you trained with, which one is the most like Mr. Parker or the most influential on you after Mr. Parker?
In the Kempo world?
Yeah.
Mr. Speakman, bar none. Mr. Speakman, he was as big as Mr. Parker. He had a Goju background, which his basics were crisp and clean. He had a mean streak in him, and he understood the system inside and out. And besides him, this is going to sound odd. There was a woman by the name of Barbara Hale, and Barbara Hale, I went to her seminar as a bad guy. she asked me to be an attacker in one of her female seminars. She was a big woman. And let me tell you what, never volunteer to be an attacker in an anti-rape American Kempo seminar ever again. I got the hell beat out of me by every woman in that place. And she moved so well and hit so hard. And she trained directly under Mr. Parker as well. So everything that that woman did was just spot on and clean. And I would grab her hard and I would put her up against the wall. And I guess Miss Hale was probably 5'8", about 155. And brother, she hit you and she'd take you to your knees real, real quick. It was amazing to watch her work. I don't know whatever happened to her, but I'll never forget that weekend. Never.
I wrote that down. I'm going to look that up.
Yeah, Barbara Hale was her name. She was amazing.
Very, very interesting. That's a very broad experience. What made you decide not to focus explicitly on one art and develop your own as far as the work's concerned?
I've just always been I love martial arts. I have since I was a kid. And there were certain little things that pushed me out of arts that, American Kempo, when Mr. Parker died, it just went upside down. And that pushed me out. And you're being forced to choose loyalties. And all I wanted to do was train. And, the people I was with, in 1 minute, it was IKKF. And then it was this guy's organization. Then it was 10 techniques. Then it was 14. Then it was 16. Then it was 26. And everybody kept forgetting the principles of motion that Mr. Parker taught was the principles of motion. Yes, he had a certain amount of techniques per belt. But all of a sudden, we're sitting there doing a system that now has 26 techniques per belt, which made it extremely hard for anybody to learn because nobody understood the principles of said motion. And it was the same thing with when I was in Goju-Ryu. I was already a black belt and I had been bouncing in a nightclub and I got stabbed very, very bad through my right lung and almost killed me. And I realized I had no idea of how to deal with a knife. And when I approached my sensei, who I revered dearly and still do because he taught me so much, asked him to teach me what I need to do with a knife on both ends. He looked at me and he told me that in Goju, the spirit of Budo, we would never deal with that. We don't work with knives in any resort. And so I made my choice to go into something that seemed to me to help me at the time, which was Pikiti Tertia, because it dealt with a knife. And then after 9 years in Pikiti Tertia, having made the rank of Lakon Guru, training, instructor's ranks and this, that, and the other, and then come to find out, the politics started taking over in the system and you were here again. You were either this guy's student or this guy and this guy. You had to pay this guy and this guy. I just said, you know what? I mean, I at that time, I was really growing sick of the martial arts period. And I left the martial art world for, I would say, probably 2 years. I only trained by myself. I didn't go with an instructor. And then the same can be said when I got into the Penchuk Silat world. I just saw while the techniques and while the things were good, I just saw a lot of stuff that it's not going to work in the United States of America because people are much bigger here and it's a different animal. And here again, I just saw, people milking a system for money and not being any really validation. And that's when I just, decided to go find Master Yuli and went over there on my own accord and flew over and stayed and train, and then I started getting a love back for it. After I came home, I didn't train anybody for a year. I just marinated in what he taught me, and then kept training with my Wing Chun, with Sifu Baker, guys who didn't play politics, guys who didn't play all this stuff, trying to stretch out a system for years to bring money in and give you some type of grand poobah certificate. After I got done with Illustrissimo in the Philippines, Yuli asked me, what do you want, a certificate or a t-shirt? I wanted the t-shirt because that t-shirt was cool as hell. And that's what I took. I mean, the paperwork, all these things are fine and they're dandy. I've got it. But to be honest with you, it's not going to save your ass in a fight. It just isn't. So I'm not a big paperwork guy. You never have.
For you, what's important is combat applicability and the ability to survive asocial violence, right?
Real not violence. To survive a social violence. My goal is to win a social violence. If you ever look at survivors, a lot of them wish they were dead after the fact. My idea when it comes to social violence is to win by any means necessary. I never needed to train martial arts to know how to fight. With my life and what I've done in my life and the bad choices that I made, and I'm very honest about my life, I only trained martial arts through all this so I could be the better ass kicker. That's the reason I got into the martial arts. There was no Zen to it. There was no, I want to be a better person. Because frankly, I don't believe in all that stuff. Because if you look at the history of a lot of the great martial artists, they were bad guys. They weren't the best of people. Tokyu Kayan from Okinawa, he ran brothels. Choki Motobu, he fought for money. He fought illegal fights. Gichin Funakoshi with the blade test during World War II on the soldiers. Ed Parker collected money in the Palama settlements. His words, not mine. Ip Man. I mean, do we need to even go into that? You know, the opium smoke. You know, so a lot of martial arts guys, they weren't the greatest of people. Only when it came to the West did everybody have this, oh, let's revere these people as gods. And sure, probably some of them were great people and some of them were whatever, Zen, Buddhist, whatever. But the vast majority of these guys were tough sons of a bucks who needed it because of the times they grew up in. And there was bad guys just like there are today and where they were at. So a lot of these guys, they filtered into that type of a world themselves. And you need to learn how to be a better ass kicker if you're going to be in that world. And that's the reason I, even through all my tumultuous life, when I was doing my dirt, I always trained. And it was for no other reason than to be better if anything did happen to me doing what I was doing. That was the bottom line.
That's a different take. I mean, but clearly that's the perspective of a guy who understands the mean streets, right? That gives you an insight that most people...
That's what I did for a lot of my life. I ran those streets. You know, I worked as a bouncer. I worked as a bounty hunter. I worked collecting money. I did things. You know, when you're in that life, you have to be able to defend yourself, not just with your hands. I'm talking with blades and guns and whatever else it was that was needed at the time.
So, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of questions one can ask there. But, I mean, we haven't yet spoken about your firearms background. That's something I'd love to touch on as well. But in terms of what you've seen as a guy who's seen what happens on the mean streets and with your experience there, what are the fundamental things that you've seen that the good guy, the guy that doesn't want to be the victim, you know, your students that you train, what are the things that you feel that they should learn and they should be aware of when they're out?
The first thing I preach to my guys is awareness. Awareness, awareness, awareness. Awareness will keep you out of a lot of trouble. And you and I had this discussion within that awareness package. You have to start understanding street mentality of people. And having been a street guy myself, for me, it's easy. I teach people what we talked about, precursor signals, listening to that inner voice. If you're seeing a guy cut across the street at you, don't make the beeline. You know, maybe take a different direction. Maybe make another angle, make another cut. Look for hands in pockets, things like that. And just the basics, especially for women students I've had, don't park at the end of the parking lot, little things like that. But, you know, a lot of these people today are talking about, you know, they're writing books on the criminal mindset and they're writing books on stuff like that. And I ask them, have you ever been a criminal? Have you ever done anything like that? Well, no. Then what are you basing your book off of? Oh, your generalizations of what you see or what you think's going on. And coming from the other side of that razor, I always tell them, I said, you're full of shit. For one simple reason, you've never walked it. Because let me tell you what, having done that and having been that for a good portion of my younger life, people always think that criminals are stupid. People always think that they make bad mistakes. And I'm here to tell them a lot of the stuff that you see in these books about what to look for, what to do, as a guy who used to do it, I look at it and I laugh. Because it's just not that way. You know, there's this mythos put onto it now that, well, this is the way he's going to do it. This is the way it's always going to be. This is what you need to do. No, no, no. It's far from that. The thing about a criminal, what makes a criminal so damn successful, is he doesn't care. Plain and simple, he does not care. He's going to change his methodology to get the job done depending on, well, something as simple like this, depending on how high he is that day. And that's something never addressed. You know, do I need a fix? Do I need a gun? What do I need? What is my goal out there today? Do I need to eat? How high am I? Did I just do some coke? Did I just do some, what did I do? And so they never look at it from those parameters. I knew guys, Lloyd, I tell you, that they would change their methods every minute. You never knew what they were going to do. And that's why they were so good at what they did. And if you caught them, guess what? Big deal. I go inside for a little bit. I get cleaned up. I get muscled up. I get food. And then I'm back out a bigger, better, stronger criminal.
Wow. Okay. That's the reality.
Yeah, it is
What are you
real.
t so what are you teaching your guys? What Okay, a couple of questions. I mean, so what is it that you are best at? What is the skill set that you really bring into the arts that you are best known for? What are the
Now,
things that you're working on hardest to improve that you think are the most relevant? And some guy walks into your gym, you're going to train this guy to be not just a survivor, but a winner, right? He's going to dominate. He's going to walk away there and he's going to go home to his family tonight. So what are the skills that he's going to learn that are critical?
well, the first thing I teach anybody who comes to me is Wing Chun, but not just cookie cutter Wing Chun. I teach old school. I get people how to move. I get people how to move their feet. I get people hitting extremely hard, extremely fast with a lot of shots, because in the streets, you have got to have empty hands. Before anything else, you have to have empty hands, because we do not walk around with a knife out and we do not walk around with a gun out. Majority of times, as a good person, you're going to be second in the equation. We know it, and nobody wants to admit it. We're going to be second in the equation. Unless your mind is made up post haste that this is about to go down, now I'm going to be first. If you understand it's going down and you have this awareness factor, because your awareness told you, oh shit, this guy's coming for me now, boom, I'm going first. That's that. But the majority of times when attacked, you may be with your girlfriend, your kids, you're going to be second. But immediately upon that engagement, you are going to become first. So I teach from the perspective of domination. I'm not just talking of hurting a guy. I'm talking about putting a guy all the way out where he does not move and he's on the ground. One story, your story, end of story. So I teach people very, very brutal, very fast.
Okay, do you find that people struggle to adopt that mindset? I agree with you. I think it's very, very necessary. This is asocial violence, right? So I'll say that if you do not step up when this goes down, you are participating in your own murder.
Yes, I tell them that
Right?
all the time. And partly the way I teach is probably one of the reasons I don't have a whole lot of students. Most of the people who come to me are grown men who already know how to fight, coming from another background or whatever. And so for me to teach them, or soldiers, for me to teach them, it's very, very simple, because especially guys I know who have been in the war and who have killed, they're very easy for me to teach because they get it. I get very few people who are soft, squishy people come to me. And the ones who have, they don't last very long, because not only am I demanding, but I'm very physical with them.
Yeah, no,
Because,
I've had that experience with you.
I'm very physical, because guess what? I'm not going to treat a female student any differently than I do a male student, for one simple reason. Why would I disrespect her in that way? Do you think that guy out here who's going to try to rape her, or that guy's going to try to beat her teeth in, is going to be nicer because she's a woman? Hell no, he's going to be rougher. So when I do drills with my guys and whoever comes to train with me, we're going to be doing hard scenarios. We're going to be working. I'm going to be taking Wing Chun out of a box that it's in, and I'm going to
Right.
teach you how to use a knife with it. How to use, I mean, we do drills where you've seen the standard chi sao, where people are just chi saoing using their empty hands, trying to find opening and positioning. Now let's put a, well, I don't know, an airsoft pistol on you in a hidden position, and now you're going to get to that pistol and try to blow my brains out. Or I'm going to try to stop you from it. Or you're going to try to pull that training blade and try to stab me, and I got to stop you from it with my empty hands. Things like that. And sure, sometimes you get a busted nose, you get a cauliflower ear, you get a cut eye, you get a whatever. But that's the reality. If you're not training hard, and you're not building scenarios, integrating guns and knives and whatever into the system, or taking your work to the ground, you're doing a disservice to your students. So I try to bring a hard edge of reality to my classes. At the same time,
So
I keep try to keep people learning structure.
let's say, for argument's sake, that what you do is desperately necessary in the broader martial arts community, right? But it's something that doesn't appeal to many. Is there a way to take critical segments of it and add that to McDojo? Is there a way to, I wouldn't say, I don't want to say water it down, but is it possible to modify it so that at least some of that reality becomes part of the framework of people learning basic martial arts? Is it a necessary part of the syllabi, or is it
Well, you also have to remember, by taking a piece of a whole and adding it to a piece of pudding, you're still going to have a nice piece of pudding. Most of the McDojo stuff that you see, most of the people in there are in there for, you know, other reasons than being able to kick the ever-living dog shit out of two people. Most of them are in there for what reason? They're in there for, oh, it's a good exercise. Oh, it's a this. Oh, I'm going to be competing. Oh, I'm doing this. Oh, I'm doing that. You take a realistic component. You see it all the time. Guys from sport mentalities, they'll go do a Krav Maga session or two. And next thing you know, they're hanging a banner and teaching Krav. But you look at it, and it's the same shit that they're doing. They're just hanging a different banner. My whole belief on it is if you I can take what I do and go to a McDojo, but the vast majority of people, once they learn it, are they going to continue practicing it? Once they learn it, are they going to take it deep in their laboratory? I live this stuff. I just don't go do this twice a week. I live it. I do it every single day for hours every day. I wake up in the morning, walk my daughter to school. The first thing I do when I come home is I hit my garage in the MOOC jump and start working placement. Ah, this is better. This is better. I'll grab a stick. I'll grab a blade. All day long, I'm in the garage or I'm in the backyard or I'm doing weightlifting or I'm doing something to make my martial combatives better, going to the range, blue gun pistol work, rifle work, shotgun over, you know, loading drills, simple mundane stuff where, you know, for me, you're not going to be good at anything unless it becomes a part of your life, unless you do it daily.
We're developing a pretty good idea of where you come from.
Yeah.
I think the term reality-based is overused in the martial arts, but I think you are very much based in reality. So who
and it depends on when they say reality-based, whose reality? That's not my reality.
That's a my very reality loose term.
Yeah, it's a very loose term. I mean, I've summoned my demons. I've done things to people. I've put people places where they don't,
I think people who've met their demons, stared them in the face, and then put them back in their box, and they know that they're there. I think those people have a very real understanding of violence, and they know the other side. You know, they see both sides.
Sure. And it's not hard to summon them again because you've done it once, at least.
Those who pretend they don't have demons, those people are deluding themselves, right?
Exactly.
We're in denial. Yeah, I mean, those aren't discussions. You know, we should have several discussions. I get this feeling. We should have plenty of discussions, perspectives, but... So a couple of brief things, because who are the students you're looking to get? I mean, I think what you do is very relevant to law enforcement, to prison warders. I think they're very relevant to soldiers. That's my perspective. But who are the students that you would love to see in your class?
I'm open to teach anybody. I don't teach kids due to the liability reasons and things like that. In this Sue Happy world, I don't teach kids except my own. I'd love to work with police officers to open their eyes to something, because sadly most police officers and most police departments in this country are trained to budget restrictions, and a lot of them, let's be honest, they just don't seek anything out past what they learned at the academy, whether that's a gun, knife, or anything.
Do you offer any programs or discounts to law enforcement people?
I've told cops 100 times, just show up and I'll teach you. Just show up. But you know what? And I'll talk pricing with them at that point. I mean, but for cops and military guys, you know, I don't charge a whole lot of money to begin with, Lloyd, to be honest with you, compared to most people. I'm not out here. I make my money when I go do workshops. I charge in San Antonio, I charge $125 a month. And I even work for everybody's schedule, because this is what I do. If you want to come at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, come at 2. If you want to come at 8 in the morning, come at 8. Right. I'll facilitate their schedule. And because I just love to teach, and I like giving that gift of empowerment. That's what I'm good at. I like to empower people, you know, and I'm very positive in how I teach and what I teach. And I'm brutally honest with people in how and what I teach.
So on that note, what do you think are your strong points? What do you think are your strong points? And what do you think you're best at? And what are you best known for? What do you think? I mean, that's one thing. That's the public perception. What is Mike best known for? But what do you feel you are best at?
What I'm best at is I'm a damn good teacher. I teach practical knowledge and I give the gift of empowerment to people. I can take people from no skills to having a very good base and a very good quality skills quickly. My whole job is with adults, I have a saying, I'm going to drop you in the deep end from day one and I bet you you'll swim, because I'm going to help you swim. I'm very good at making these arts that I teach fit the person, not the person fit them. Because I've been doing it a real long time. That's my strong suit. Physicality and all that, that's a given. But I know how to depart information to people. And I've trained with MMA guys. I have trained with BJJ guys. And I know I understand body mechanics and I understand motion and I understand these things. But what I think I'm best known for, to be honest with you, what most people know me, most people have different perceptions of me. They either love me or they hate me. But very few people understand me because I'm very, what I'm known for is I'm very outspoken. And I'm not a, I am not a person that's going to tell you what's right. I'm going to tell you what's real, whether that pisses you off or not. And I don't give a shit what we're talking about, politics, race, whatever you want to talk about. I'm going to tell you what's real because I'm 54 years old. I've been on this earth a long damn time. And I've seen a lot of things. And I'm not going to sit and talk about what's right. I'm going to tell you exactly what's real.
Hey, look, I do want to make a plug here. I think it's only fair. Well, without getting too deep into the whole history and the politics, but I mean, you've been a good friend. You've stood by me. You've been loyal. And despite some pretty rough incidents that we were both involved in, you know, people have said things that have been entirely unfair. They've called you all sorts of disparaging names. And from my perspective, I'll bring this out. But as a black man from Africa, none of those things that were said about you were true. You know, you're a good friend. You know,
yeah.
You're a very loyal friend.
I've been called racist. I've been called misogynist. Yeah. I've been called Ku Klux Klan. I've been called everything. And I always found that so odd. My late wife was Filipino and my daughter's half Filipino. And my son's half Filipino. And I have black students. I have white students. I've had Mexican students. I've had all these things.
I know. I've met such a wonderful, diverse range of guys at your school. And that is unfortunately the politics and the martial arts. And I mean, people use these as ways to disparage people simply to, there's no need for it, but they want to destroy you for whatever reasons. And that's, I've known you for a long time.
Hey, Wes said it best, my friend. Go ahead and talk all the bad stuff you want to talk about me, because publicity, baby, is still publicity. Thank you very much.
I don't want to go too far down that road, but all those things, all those statements, I mean, I'll say no, they're not true. You know, you're no racist. I've been called a white supremacist as a black guy, which is fun.
Well, you do have high cheekbones.
Oh well, yeah, but I'm black where it counts, right?
Yeah, there you go, man. So am I. I'm black from the waist down. What the hell?
You know? Oh yeah. So
if we're gonna go there. Let's go all the way there.
Yeah, well, that's fine. Yeah. So the thing is, so back to the question. So what are you best known for? Just for being outspoken, which I think you are. Now, in terms of the skills that you're not known for, I think we've spoken a little bit about that. Just give us a brief overview. I'd like to move to blade arts and the firearms, right? But in terms of the blade arts, what is it? I know you're an expert with the Bowie, and you may have some other skills that I'm not aware of as well. So you want to talk a little bit about that, please?
I love all blades except karambits. I hate them damn things. My hands are so big, I've never found one with a hole big enough to fit. And I just think they're a limited blade. But yeah, I am a proponent of big steel. I came in Texas. We're allowed to carry what we want, and I carry a Randall Mark II dagger, which is big. And I also carry, depending on the day and depending on how crazy I am, I'll carry a big Bowie. And I carry it usually right down on my right leg. And I also have a little bit smaller one that I designed called a Warthog that I carry in my lower back when I carry it. But I'm a firm believer in big steel because I don't care what knife system or what system you come at me with. I pull 11 inches of steel and I come at you with it. You're going to get hurt due to one simple fact. I don't have to move that thing. I'm just going to let you run into it. I'm a big proponent of that. And I'm also a big proponent of ambushing people. And let's be honest, a knife, no matter what the size, is not a dueling weapon. It is a ambush weapon. And if I know it's going to go down and I know it's going to go this way, I'm going to bring my blade out way before you even know it's coming. I'm just going to cleave you. Yes. Is that right? No, but it's real. If you're going to stand there with me and you're going to pull out a knife and I'm going to pull out a knife, we're both dumbasses. We both deserve to get shot at that point because that's not the realism on the street. You and I have had this discussion with Piper. Piper's an ambush art the way I see it. It really, really is. I mean, it's predicated on the ambush and it works beautifully at that. That's why I like it. And it's no different than a crackhead over here in North Carolina with a Phillips screwdriver in his hand. His whole idea is what? There's a motivation behind the intent. That's what it is. So by knowing all these type of things and by training this type of art, it gives you an idea of what to look for, how to do things, and you know, stuff like that. But with a blade in your hand, you have got to be first, because if not, there may not be a second.
So on a technical level, What do you think are the, besides people's misconceptions, right? So, but that aside, I mean, I think that's a pretty long discussion on its own. But on a technical level, what are the primary, or the, let's say, what are the, some of the early skills that people have to learn? Like you said, the draw, obviously, getting it out, which obviously depends on prior to that recognition, right? But what are the early skills people need to learn, and what are the, what are some of the more difficult skills or the forgotten skills that, that might be overlooked that you think are primary for learning to use edge weapons?
I think one of the first things you have to do, learn with an edge weapon, is how to manipulate your feet and your body with it and let the big blade eat. A lot of people try to swing it like they're, you see so many people swinging tomahawks like they're helicopters and big blades and all that. It's a bigger blade. The way I teach it is learn how to move that in segments with to your body and just mirror this guy. Whatever he comes in, put that blade there, let him into that edge. That, keep it really simple. Let the weight of the dog eat. Let that buoy eat. Don't try to overswing it because it's a bigger blade that's gonna take you off your mark if you do that. Harder things to learn are just basic. People teach incortata, people teach up down cuts and through cuts and passing with the hands. Anytime you start putting a secondary or a third hand, some call it, into the mix, things get a little difficult. That's the higher end skills. But to be basic with it, learn how to move your feet, learn how to articulate your body to the weapon and put it where they're coming in at. Let them run into it. Learn how to do I teach my buoy off of a template. Learn how to just make simple chops, simple cuts, simple thrust, and move out, move out, move out. Keep everything relative to your body. Keep everything in your box. I don't move my blade high above my head. I don't drop it way down low. I keep everything. If I extend my arm straight out, that's the length and the width of my box. All my blade work is going to stay inside that box due to the fact that you also have to stay safe. If you're sitting there swinging big, crazy winging blows with that blade, with a heavy blade, where's your body going to go? With that
With the
blade,
blade,
your center is still going to, you're still going to manipulate your center. Hence, a lot of my big blade comes from the Wing Chun theories of center manipulation. So, if you do those things and keep it relatively simple, you'll have something. I can teach a guy how to use a buoy in 2 sessions, and he'll be very good with it in 2 sessions at the basics and practical motion. Now, if you're going to add all the other things, now you're going to talk about a little time. But let's be honest, in a situation where your buoy has to come out, be simple and be practical and end it. Because I don't know too many people are going to stay in the fight after you lob off a couple fingers. And that, here again, that may not be right, but it's real. I've seen it happen. Guys are saying, "Oh, I'll just push my hand into my pocket or under my arm and keep fighting." Okay, sure. Yeah, sure you will. Okay, with all that blood spewing and all that blood loss and all this stuff and all the adrenaline dump, that's another portion that people don't leave out. They leave out with violence. They literally believe that if Lloyd takes his blade, the one that I gave you, and you jam that down through the clavicle, they're just going to slap a hand on that and they're just going to keep on coming. It don't work that way. It just doesn't. The human body can only take so much damage, and the human brain and all these things are going to kick in, and the safe mode is going to come on where they're going to try to save themselves because that's human nature. And those are things that are also left out of the discussion when it comes to self-defense or self-preservation. Those things are always left out. It's kind of like the old John Wayne movie when a guy gets shot twice and he keeps fighting. Really? I got shot in the ass with rock salt as a kid, and I was done. I was done. It blew me off my feet, and I was like, "Holy shit, I'm bleeding out of my ass here."
I'm just curious. I want to plug something, maybe just to let people know that we've got an upcoming seminar later in this year, and we're planning to do a contrasting session on Big Blade Bowie, your Wing Chun, and myself on the short range. So, yeah, do you just want to mention a few words about that?
Yeah, we're going to be doing that in the end of September. Just stay tuned for more. It'll be in San Antonio, Texas. Just stay tuned for more information because I'm working out logistics for a nice venue. I got a few things in mind that you and I will discuss, and it's going to be a workshop that's going to open eyes to possibilities, to limitations, and how to blend your methods from side to side, from art to art. And that's what it's going to be.
Yeah, just so everyone who's listening knows as well, we're in discussions now with a third party as well, so we may be adding some more to the mix, and we may be coming to LA. So
Exactly.
yeah,
Let's do it.
yeah,
Ready? Have
so that
skills, we'll travel.
say that again, Mike.
Have skills, we'll travel.
Definitely, definitely. We're going to work on that. I think we're going to try and shake it up, look at different ranges, different applications, perspectives. The weapon influences the fight, right? And it influences the...
Yeah, all weapons. That's why the CMOC saying is boots to blade, gun to ground, be good everywhere.
Yeah, no. So that's coming up. But we definitely, I'm excited about that. I'm looking forward to being with you guys in Texas and having some really good pulled pork again.
And we'll do some gun work too. Guns are my another passion for
and
me.
That's the next question. So yeah, that's the one that we haven't spoken about. So tell us a bit about your qualifications, experience, just so that everyone knows.
Gun work, I started when I was just a kid. My father was 101st Airborne. He was Recondo. I grew up with guns. I grew up loaded guns in the house. You know, you just grew up around it, shooting. My father was one of the best shots in the U.S. Army, shot on the Army rifle team. I've got the clippings and, you know, him making 500 out of 500 in competition. Plus he was, you know, he saw his fair share. And so he taught me how to run guns when I was a kid. And then of course, going in the Army myself, you know, I learned what the Army had to offer in my time in the early 80s, which wasn't quite what it was today. We didn't do a lot of CQB and things like that. But then, you know, when I came out of the service, I just kept running guns and I would go to courses and I still go to courses. I just finished up a Naval SEAL course, this weekend on basic carbine work, on just learning how to really run an M4 carbine. While I knew how to run it, I just always go back to courses that touch on basics. And I've trained with Navy SEALs. I've trained with Rangers. I've trained with Green Berets. I've trained with Spetsnaz. I've trained with SWAT. I've trained with civilian instructors. I did all my stuff through the NRA, all their inside the home, outside the home instructors courses. I did all these things. And then what I like to do is to take a little bit of everything and learn how to run as much as possible. I'm a firm believer that you need to learn how to run an AK-47. You need how to learn how to run an M4, a FAL, semi-automatic pistols, whether it be 1911, whether it have decockers, whether it be a Glock, whether it be revolvers, and learn how to run all these battlefield weapons because you never know what you have to pick up. But I'm a firm believer that firearms are the highest form of martial discipline that there are, for one simple reason. There is no do-overs. When you're training firearms, it has to be taken that serious. When that bullet leaves that barrel, somebody's life has changed forever. When that gun comes out, somebody's life has changed forever. So with knowing that, I look at the firearm as the highest level of martial discipline. But it is a martial art just like all the others. Matter of fact, I take my Illustrissimo footwork, I take my Wing Chun work, and I fit it to my pistol work especially. But it can be done with rifle work as well. And I'm a firm believer that you have to run your pistol and your rifle martially, not just standing there flat-footed, shooting at a target. Yes, that's a step, and that's a good step to have because you have to build basics. But sooner or later, you have to start moving with your weaponry. You have to start moving to cover, learning how to deploy and move and shoot with single-handed. It's called a handgun, not hands. And learning how to do things like this and make it a martial art, how to take that gun from 2 feet in all the way back out to 25, 30 meters, you know, things like that.
I agree with you. Guns should be treated as a martial art, as a comprehensive series of skills. Two, what I do find is lacking, we don't have time to really get into the whole critique, but there needs to be more application in terms of, well, training application in terms of moving from empty hand to gun. And of course, guns to other weapons, as well as, you know, keeping a gun off you when things go rough, and then, you know, being able to access under duress.
Hence, why I teach everybody, start everybody with Wing Chun, because I think they're the best hands to deal with that. And I teach my guys how to go from a pox out, bongs out, chop to the neck, drop down. That's why I believe in carrying all my weapons on my appendix area, blades on my side, where I can access.
Just for people who don't speak Wing Chun, do you want to define a Pak Sao or Bong Sao?
Yeah, Pak Sao may be if I'm standing with my hands. I never, if the situation is going to occur, I'm never going to have my hands low. I'm always going to have my hands in what I call a modified fence. Of course, in Wing Chun, you have a guard system, which is called Man Sao leading hand, Wu Sao backhand, or a boxing stance similar to. But that also, there's also things out there called CCTV cameras and witnesses. I don't want to look like the aggressor, so I kind of put my hands up in a passive, you know, way. We call it bitch hands or prayer hands.
Right.
But from that position, a pox out, if a punch comes in, I can move offline quickly and jam it with the palm of my hand into the whatever.
I'm with you, yeah. So you've got up a fence, and you've got layers of defense to put a guy to work through.
I got layers of defense that they're going to have to come through. If he throws a secondary punch, I can throw what some people in Kempo, they called it an outside block, very similar to a Lansau or a Bongsau, however you want to stop that. And everything fill it in between is with strikes. Knowing how to do all these things, I can create enough distance and enough time to be able to either back out or draw from position and go to the weapon right there if need be. I teach all this from what I call the CMOC ladder. It's basically our force continuum ladder. And when you see the force continuum ladder that I develop, there's always awareness first. Up the second rung is empty hand. The third rung is edged impact. And the fourth rung is firearms. And of course, the fifth rung again is awareness, always doubling up. So learning how to run this ladder, because sometimes once the awareness factor kicks in, or sometimes when the awareness factor doesn't kick in due to the fact that the OODA loop is incomplete, there's a missing O, the oh shit factor. You're grabbed out of nowhere.
I've started using that, Mike. I've started using that term in training.
You should use it because it's true.
No, I did it last sometimes. Night. I was teaching last night. The instructor's out of town, so I had the class last night. And I was saying, look, when the technique goes wrong and you're standing there looking at the guy, that's the oh shit position.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. And once you understand that, sometimes understanding the ladder through training and through all the scenario work that you do, sometimes you're not going to run it awareness first. You're grabbed. I may have to go straight to the gun at this point. But how do I get to the gun? The empty hand component has to be there. How do I get to the knife? I just can't. Somebody's grabbing me. He's going to let me pull. So I got to have an empty hand to be able to create that space or that distance or hurt him enough for me to get to what I need to get to. And once I get to it, now I can go to work. But without it, you're done. That's why I tell gun guys, they always say, well, I'm a gun guy. I'll just pull my gun and go to work. No, you won't. It doesn't happen that way. It doesn't happen that way. Hence, and I tell empty hand guys, what happens if I got a Glock and we're in a firefight? What are you going to do? Learn how to run guns.
Yeah, Mike, I could chat all night, but we got to start winding it down so this is not too long. But I'd love to have this chat with you again and probably again and again.
Cool. I'm always here, man. I'm always willing to chat about
it. I think we have lots to talk about. I'm just so a couple of things before we wrap up. I mean, this has been a fascinating chat. I learned a great deal. It was a lot of fun. If I could, this is a small plug for myself. What made you decide to invite me over for training originally, and then what made you decide to invite me back?
Basically, I always knew of your skill. I always knew of Piper. I had seen video clips of it, and it kind of fascinated me. And you always talked about movement and motion, and that was the first thing that kind of gravitated me towards you, because you came with such a different motion than what I was used to. And I figured the more I could learn about that motion, and then when we started talking about tripwire and the ideas of smuggling and all these different little things, physicality and stuff like that, which I've taken and put into my Wing Chun, it was just a no-brainer to teach with you, to come learn from you and bring you over. And that's why I want to continue the relationship, because there's so much to learn. Plus, you come from a different part of the world. You see different bad guys. You see all these different things. And I just find it fascinating to talk with people from other parts of the world about their culture and about how they view things and how they see things. Not even some in martial arts wise too, but just world events as well. I mean, it's a fascinating discussion, which we've had over barbecue and beer, you know, so things like that. And, you know, you're just good people and you're good to hang out with. We're still trying to get you to move to Texas. Wouldn't that piss off the masses? That'd be awesome.
Yeah, that would be for good fun.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, good people gravitate towards good people no matter what anybody else said. And, you know, like I said, with what we've been through with the other side of the hill, I mean, I'm to the point with that, the hell with them. We're going to do what we're going to do. And if they don't like it, they can go kick rocks. And I hope they hear that.
Right, man.
I don't care.
Hey, look, we're doing our own thing and life is good. I think we've 2018's new year, man. We've started it with the bang.
I think so, too.
I mean, your calendar is pretty full. Your schedule is looking full. I think, you know, things are looking positive for you. Things are looking very positive for me this year. I've got the U.S. seminar tour coming up. I've got Chicago. I've got Los Angeles with Mark Denny and the Dog Brothers. I've got
nice.
San Francisco coming up. I've got, which is a big event, the Legacy of the Blade. And I've got Bozeman, Montana. And then later in the year, I've got, we've got our own event that we're busy planning. And so, yeah, we're putting together, well, you know, we've got the little secret sauce we're working on. And So very excited.
Yeah, I'm getting ready to go all over myself. I'm getting ready to head out in the end of March, and I got April booked. I got May booked. I got everything booked.
Tell us about the next couple of upcoming events. So if people want to meet you at these events, you know, what will you be doing?
Yeah, I'm going to Phoenix. I'll be out there. Let's see. Let me pull my calendar. I'll be in Phoenix with Brian Halliday on upcoming workshop. Here we go. 3/22nd and 23rd. Or that 22nd, 24th, 25th in Arizona with Brian Halliday out in Phoenix. We're going to be doing Wing Chun and CMOC Knife. April 23rd, 24th, and 25th up in Indiana, Richmond, Indiana, at Malk Training Facility. I'm going to be doing my gut bucket work, the 23rd pistol, 24th is rifle, and the 25th will be a combo. May 12th and 13th, I'll be in Augusta, Georgia with Brian Cannata, having Wing Chun Concepts. July, I'll be back up in Indiana with Mao teaching the Wing Chun Concepts. And then August, I have people coming in here. Mark Human will be coming in here in August 4th to the 11th doing MBW gun seminars. September 8th and 9th, I'll have Terry Trahan in, and we're going to be doing the Junkyards Perspective in San Antonio. And then right after that, you're coming in, and we're going to be tearing that one up for a few days. And we'll see what the rest of the year pans out.
Okay, sounds good, man. Glad to hear you. Yeah. Well, glad to see that things are booming your side. Okay, final thing then. So if people want to contact you, how do they get hold of you? What website, phone numbers, all of those things?
Oh, man, they can contact me at I don't have a website. The websites I always found are But check me out on Facebook, Mike Wanna Blackgrave, or check me out on Instagram, same name. And you can contact me at mblackgrave@gmail.com, and we'll take it from there.
Radio. Does anyone phone you? Do you put out your phone number, or is that something you...
No, I don't put out my phone number, man. I got too many enemies, which is a good thing.
Yeah, no worries. Just wanted to be sure that, we can all get hold of you in terms of your business.
I always got my cell phone with me, so whoever contacts me, I'll get right back at them real quick.
Yeah, no worries. Okay, Mike, thank you very much. I'm going to be... I this has been a great chat. I'm glad we had this opportunity, and I'm really good. It's really good to know you and call you a friend. Much appreciated.
Awesome, man. Fantastic. Look forward to the next time.
Same here, and me too. Cheers, man. Have a good day.
All right. Be good, my friend. Bye bye.